great pleasure and privilege to introduce a long-time friend and acquaintance and distinguished social anthropologist, Polly Hill, who is going to talk briefly about her life in Cambridge and her very distinguished work in Africa and India and in the Fens. So, Polly, it's delightful to have you with us, and whenever you'd like to start.
Thank you, Alan. Curiously, I start by saying that my greatest gift is that of reading poetry aloud. But no one knows this, as I am too shy to read in public. My maternal grandfather, John Neville Keynes, was a Cambridge don, a moral scientist who became registry, who arrived in Cambridge in 1872 and kept every term, as they say, until he died 77 years later, at the age of 97, in 1949, leaving behind a fair spattering of descendants associated with Cambridge University, a spattering which has meanwhile increased. My mother was born in Cambridge, as I was myself, but my claim to indigenous descent is somewhat marred by my departure for Manchester at the age of 6. However, I reappeared at Newnham College in 1933. I was automatically debarred from keeping every term thereafter by the dreadful rule that one could not be a research student unless one had a first. I got a 2-1 in economics, and only one woman, who had not even been Joan Robinson, had done better. So it was a cruel rule. In the event, I was, as a result, to wait 17 years until I entered academia through the back door of a colonial university. In 1938, I became a research assistant at the Fabian Society, financed by Frank Pattenham, now Lord Longford, and wrote a book on unemployment, which was published in 1940. This was a very boring book, but in accordance with practice at that time, it got a full-page review in the New Statesman by G.D.H. Cole. Reverting to my memories of Cambridge in the First World War, I had a bad war because Cambridge was a military centre, and my earliest memory is of Armistice Day 1918, when a terrible weight fell off my small 4-year-old shoulders. Having recently removed to central Cambridge, I am still suffering from that war. I languished as a civil servant during the war, and even more pathetically for some time thereafter. As a temporary civil servant, I fetched up in the statistics department of the colonial office, the corrupt head of which... That's all right. The corrupt head of which used to tear out pages from files when he didn't agree. One of our functions was to instruct colonies on how to guess plausible figures when, for example, they undertook those absurd agricultural censuses. The only worthwhile thing I did was to persuade the office that when a colony imported banknotes with a notional face value of £1 million, they should cease to be valued at £1 million in that poor colony's trade accounts, but should be regarded as merchandise valued at their cost of production, say £20,000. At last I resigned and became unemployed for some 6 months. My greatest stroke of luck was to be taken on as commercial editor by David Williams, the inspired editor of that weekly paper, West Africa. The colonial office never sent anyone to visit a colony, but David Williams did. I came to life for the first time since my childhood when I landed in the Gold Coast in December 1952. Immediately on landing, I felt I had come to a new planet and was freed from my difficult Cambridge background. My life was forever changed. It was wonderful to arrive in a colony which was leading the way towards independence in Africa, which was to be achieved there in 1957. It was an electric time. In 1953, I married a white man who happened to be stationed in the Gold Coast. And after a tussle with Cecil King, a renowned and awful predecessor of Robert Maxwell on the Daily Mirror, which owned the paper West Africa, I got the sack as a journalist. Though I recommend high-class journalism as a wonderful introduction to such a region as West Africa, I was now freed to take up research, which I continued to do in Ghana until 1965. That is to say, 12 years later, that being a year before the discredited Nkrumah fell. I felt secure in this work because the other two posts of research fellow in the University of the Gold Coast were always unfilled, people preferring to be lazy lecturers. However, when pregnant in 1956, I was sacked again, this time by the Vice-Chancellor of the University of the Gold Coast, who was, I regret to say, a Cambridge man. His argument was that it would be so embarrassing for him if a young man wanted my post. He didn't mention the two vacancies. I successfully, though painfully, fought this dismissal and was reinstated before the birth of my daughter in 1956, an event which enormously improved the quality of my professional work, a fact which I want to emphasize to the utmost of my ability. It is not the case that motherhood and intellectual work necessarily conflict with each other.
How did it help, actually? You say it enormously improved and increased.
I felt such a satisfaction in being a mother.
Yes.
That I set out with a renewed vigour.
Yes.
Into the cocoa country. And immediately saw the point of what I was doing. I wasn't having to live away from Susanna,
yes,
because I never spent the night away.
Yes.
I didn't go more than 3 days a week into the cocoa forests,
yes,
and worked otherwise in my study at home,
yes,
and had an excellent Ghanaian woman to look after her. And life was extremely satisfactory because I had to write my notes and so on other days. And I went to different places every day. I wasn't working in one particular village.
So you think if she hadn't been born, in fact your work would have been much worse?
Oh, yes. I would have stagnated. I mean, I had been working on cocoa farmers for some time before this event of the birth of my daughter occurred, and had entirely missed the point.
Being? What was the point?
The point was that the development, as I shall come to, of the cocoa growing industry was due to the migration of cocoa farmers who bought large areas of land. This was not in the books. This was one of the great events in sub-Saharan Africa, which was altogether unrecorded. I was extremely fortunate in encountering this subject.
Yes.
This happened in southern Ghana, but not in Ashanti. As a married woman, I was employed on a monthly basis. Everybody else was, of course, on a proper contract. But even so, one took a long-term view of one's prospects. Nobody told me what research to do. Nobody, indeed, took the faintest interest. And equipped with a mileage allowance and an 8-horsepower Fiat car, I plunged into the cocoa forests. Why cocoa? Because the Ghanaian economy was almost entirely dependent on that crop. And also because the post-war interdisciplinary team in Ashanti, which had studied cocoa farmers, had published hardly anything. Maya Fortis was much the most distinguished member of that team, and I hasten to add that his excellent chapter on kinship and marriage among the Ashanti in the book African Systems of Kinship and Marriage was in itself a sufficient justification for the existence of the team. In 1954, when I started work, little reliable research had been done on cocoa farmers as distinct from the crop cocoa, except by W.H. Beckett. But he failed to realize the significance of the migration. Of southern Ghanaian cocoa farmers, as most lamentably I did myself for some years, which shows the necessity of taking a long view of field research, as seems to be almost impossible these days. In 1956, being understandably in a great hurry owing to the behaviour of the Vice-Chancellor, I produced a rather pathetic little book entitled The Gold Coast Cocoa Farmer, a Preliminary Survey, a paperback issued by the OUP. There were 10 chapters. But fortunately, I think that the 3 chapters on cocoa farm labourers and another 3 on the pledging of cocoa farms are still useful. My pioneering work on the labourers was wholly ignored for some quarter of a century when some Ghanaian academics did the research again, ignorant of what had gone before. So much for the transitoriness of library paperbacks. I did fieldwork in Ghana for 11 years, a period which was interrupted by a year in Cambridge as Smuts visiting fellow. Fortunately, Meyer Fortis had visited Ghana after independence and put forward my name for the fellowship. He was astonished to discover after my arrival that I was a Cambridge indigene. Please do not take too rosy a view of my time in Ghana. As a lowly research fellow, I never had an assistant or an office. As assistants, I relied on English-speaking Ghanaians I met in the cocoa areas, most notably men called liaison officers, the lowest level of life in the Department of Agriculture, whose duty was to befriend the farmers. These charming men, whose presence always made my arrival in any village seem respectable, were quite unsurprised by my requests for help. Asked no questions and expected and received no pay from me. I was utterly dependent also on the very expert Ghanaian cartographers in the Department of Agriculture who were mapping cocoa farms in connection with compensation for the uprooting of trees suffering from swollen shoot disease. By the way, my first principle in all my fieldwork throughout my life has been never to ask permission from high-ranking officials or anyone else for fear it would be refused. When in Hausaland in northern Nigeria, I twice mapped the farmland using official aerial photographs and I was never challenged. This work formed the basis of my study of economic inequality. The migrant cocoa farmers, about whom more shortly, spoke a multitude of different languages, having diverse homelands. While I partly agree that I ought to have been prevented from evolving into an economic anthropologist owing to my profound linguistic abilities, which were, however, shared by no other than W.H.R. Rivers, I yet want to add...
When you say your linguistic abilities, you mean inabilities?
Did I say disabilities?
Disabilities.
I hope.
You find it very difficult to learn.
I'm hopeless. Completely hopeless, as was W.H.R. Rivers. Not that he was out... for long in the bush, but I mean, he still was hopeless.
But you said that you learnt German quite well and then repressed it in the Second World War.
Yes, that's true, but nevertheless, I worked with an interpreter in Hauserland for years.
Yes.
And never acquired any Hauser.
Well, maybe it's that the other way around. Because you had an interpreter, you never learnt any Hauser, rather than because you didn't have any Hauser, you worked with an interpreter, if you see what I mean.
I mean, the dictionary, which is a very, very great dictionary by Bargery, which is a kind of encyclopedia, was my constant companion.
Yes.
So I was extremely aware of the significance of the words that mattered.
Did you ever systematically try to learn the language?
Not systematically, because I knew it was hopeless.
Do you think this was a serious weakness?
No, I do not. I think it was advantageous. If you have a very good friend who is your interpreter,
yes,
the proceedings of talking to people are slowed up by the questioning process,
yes,
which is involved in interpretation, enabling one to take notes at the right pace. And I learnt this when I, much later, worked in the Fens,
yes,
where I found the people rambled on in a way which I found quite intolerable, and I could keep no order in the conversation because I could not ask them questions in the same way as I could when I was working through an interpreter. I think that there is a lot to be said for working through interpreters. And as I say, I was very interested in words. Indeed, I had glossaries and so on, but I did not speak the language. It is essential to know the words and to have the Bargery dictionary is one of the great dictionaries of the world.
Mm.
And I was fortunate enough to be able to obtain a copy.
Mm.
You must have that.
So you would be able to pick up particular words that were used?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes, yes. And I mean, I would say to the interpreter, what was the word used?
Mm.
And so don't think that one is not taking any interest in language.
Mm.
One is taking a great interest in language. It's just that one lacks the ability to to express oneself in the language. And I venture to think quite a number of people who think that they're good at languages miss a good deal because of their feeling that it's disreputable to work with an interpreter. I had a close friend called Rennie Pittin, a very excellent anthropologist who worked in Hauserland, who was an excellent linguist in Hausa, but she always went out with an interpreter, for which I admired her. The historic cocoa-growing area of southern Ghana, in which land was bought by the migrants, was a hinterland lying some 20 miles north of Accra, the coastal capital of Ghana. During most of the 19th century, for reasons which are still not properly understood, this hinterland was mainly afforested and mainly inhabited by hunters. Many years later, it occurred to me that my motive in exploring this northern hinterland stemmed from my love of exploring Darkor in my adolescent years, which lay north of a bungalow owned by the Hill family in South Devon. Darkmoor was much the same shape as the historic cocoa-growing area. My work in the hinterland showed that it was the migrants who bought their land for cash. It was a hire purchase system, such that the bulk of the cash was paid out over a very long period of, say, 20 to 30 years, from the proceeds of growing cocoa on the purchased land. This was very interesting, but nobody has ever followed up my work on this absolutely fascinating subject. I am astonished that nobody followed up my work on the migrant cocoa farmers until all the maps disappeared in the course of time on which my work was based.
They have all disappeared.
I'm sure they must have. It was the migrants who bought their land, as I've said, for cash and paid for it over a period of 20 to 30 years in many cases, who had been responsible for creating the Gold Coast cocoa industry, nil in the 1890s, the largest world exporter in 1911. This was entirely contrary to prevailing orthodoxy, which I had earlier accepted myself, which held that A, land was never sold, of course this is true in many localities, and that B, the industry was created by indigenous food farmers, most of whom incidentally were women in the south, who inserted this crop into their existing farms. All my colleagues in the Department of Economics in the University of Ghana concluded that I was mad. My book, Migrant Cocoa Farmers, 1963, is of course out of print. The Cambridge Press is no longer interested. So I recently tried to interest two American university presses in a paperback. Both wrote back saying that they had consulted their development experts, in quotes, who said they had not heard of the book, which would not be used for teaching. It was because I knew that they would not have heard of these natives, in quotes, who undertook their own economic development, building roads as well as bridges over the river Densu that lay between their homeland and the land that they bought, that I thought that the minds of the development experts, whose premises are so seriously wanting, would be whitened by a paperback. Amazingly, Gold Coast farmers hired themselves a Swiss contractor before 1914 to build three sturdy footbridges across the river, charging tolls. The colonial government was entirely ignorant of this indigenous development program. I am, however, glad to say that the International African Institute has come to my rescue and that a paperback of migrant cocoa farmers, which is regarded by them as an anthropological classic, although I was an economist at the time when I wrote it, will be published within the next year or two. I wrote to migrant cocoa farmers while I was Smuts visiting fellow in 1960 to 61. My gratitude to Meyer Fortis is very great. Fairly soon after returning to Ghana in 19...
Are you going to say anything later about Meyer, or is that the point at which you could just say something about him when you came to Cambridge that time? What sort of person he was? How he influenced you?
Well, he was certainly a great influence on me.
Hmm.
And I found his writings on Ashanti terribly important. And of course I found him so agreeable.
In what way was he agreeable?
Supportive of one's work. He was a snob, but it was rather embarrassing when he found out that I had Cambridge connections. Because he didn't know when he encouraged me to come to Cambridge that I had these connections.
When you say he was a snob,
well, he attached a lot of importance to the fact that I was Keynes, you see.
I see.
Mm. And in this connection, I can tell you that 11 descendants of John Neville Keynes, including John Neville Keynes himself, have been fellows of Cambridge colleges. So this may be a record.
Yes. And you, of course, are...
A fellow of Clare Hall.
Yes. What relative to John Maynard?
John Maynard Keynes was my mother's brother.
Yes. And so Meyer was a very nice man, was he? I mean, he was a pleasant and supportive.
Yes, I later on, when he had married Doris, I visited him in Tallensi country.
Yes.
This was in 1963. And... took a photograph to which I attached much importance of the chiefs there, which he said was the best photo ever taken of the Tallensi people. I'm not sure what to do with this photo.
Well, I'd love to have a copy, but at some point we could discuss that.
Yes.
Well, did you form, just to finish that, did you form any impression of how good a field worker he was from the visit? Or his fieldwork methods when you visited him in 1962? Did he live
63.
Did he live in a village, or...?
No, he wasn't able to do that. It was a very brief return visit.
I see.
Yes, no, certainly not. I'm sure that he was a wonderful fieldworker.
And he spoke the language?
Oh, yes. Oh, he's a wonderful fieldworker. Of course he was. Yes. And a dedicated man.
Mm.
Mm. Oh, yes, I have the utmost regard for Meyer. Soon after returning to Ghana in 1961 from Cambridge, no one noticed that I was over 2 months late. I was fortunate enough to move from the economics department, where I was a fish out of water, to the flourishing African Studies Center, where I was so happy to be a colleague of two African historians, Thomas Hodgkin, who I greatly loved, an Oxford indigene, see his book Nigerian Perspectives, and Ivor Wilkes, of Asante fame, who has just returned as an indigene to Wales. Despite Nkrumah's increasing megalomania, he did his best to destroy the migrant cocoa farmers. Life in Ghana continued to be fascinating. I worked on numerous topics, one of which related to a strange grassy hinterland to the east of Accra. An ecologically most anomalous area where cattle flourished, for there was no trypanosomiasis. The Gar men who owned many of the cattle were mainly descended from fishermen. As they knew nothing whatsoever about cattle rearing, they hired Fulani men from faraway countries to the north to look after their kraals. It was again in connection with cattle I went to that hinterland behind all other hinterlands, northern Ghana, spiritual home of Fortis, Two Goodies, and Drucker et al., and was very much surprised to find that cattle owners were very eager sellers of male animals. Some said over-eager. which was, again, entirely contrary to prevailing orthodoxy, and, for all I know, continues to be so today.
Did you write about that as well?
Yes. Those who doubt this may refer to my studies in rural capitalism in West Africa, a book published in 1970, of course, now out of print. Elsewhere in Ghana, I did a lot of work in marketplaces. In 1965, I was unfortunately obliged to leave Ghana, not because of Nkrumah, who was making life in the university very uncomfortable, but because my daughter was one of those rare people at that time who was unprotected by any kind of anti-malarial pill. I became unemployed and lived as an indigene in Cambridge. Fortunately, however, I became a research fellow of Clare Hall, unpaid. I hope that present-day younger anthropologists who are unemployed will take courage from this midlife crisis of a single parent who did not even think of herself as such. Between 1965 and 1973, when I was unexpectedly appointed Smuts Reader in the Department of Social Anthropology, my fieldwork was all done in Hausaland in northern Nigeria, to which I made several lengthy visits. Two books, both out of print, resulted, both of them to a very large extent based on these aerial photographs I have earlier mentioned. In one of these Hausa villages, I was almost a temporary indigene, for I lived in a lovely large clay house in the centre of the village, which had been built for me. This is in fact a very unusual thing for anyone to have done in Hausaland. I do not know anyone who did it.
Who had a house built for them?
Or lived in a village doing research. They always sat in a city like Zaria and just went out into the bush. But I lived in...
Did John Peel work in that area? Or?
No.
He didn't?
No. It was a village called Bartagarawa. I was Uwa Gida Binta. Binta, the mother of a house. And I was delighted to have my daughter and niece visit me there, so I felt as though I was a proper member of the society. I was precariously supported by grants. However, I spent most of my time in Cambridge, or rather from 1969 in a house on stilts on the bank of the Great Ouse River, 14 miles away. My house was not in the Fens, for to the north my hinterland consisted of a plateau occupied by R.A.F. Witten. Alan McFarlane thinks that he is the only member of the Department of Social Anthropology who actually lives in the Fens.
From which you're now speaking. You are now in the Fens,
probably. Oh. In 1977, I was so dissatisfied with my life as an indigene, and be it admitted by the department, departmental craze for pseudo-Marxism, which was intent on destroying my type of economic anthropology, all the more maddening, as I had been through it all before in the 1930s, that I literally fled at a moment's notice for a year's leave in South India.
And you say you've been through it all before. Well, in what way in the 1930s?
The 1930s Marxism in Cambridge, as you know from John Cornford et al., was very, very strong. And so I was not a Marxist. I always admired Marxists in a very pathetic fashion and felt it was most unfortunate I couldn't make it.
Couldn't be a believer.
No, I mean, it was like admiring people who adopt a certain religion.
Yes.
And not being able,
yes,
to follow that religion yourself.
Yes.
So I knew it all before, but of course nobody else in the department had been through it before.
Yes.
And I just saw they were going through this thing temporarily.
Yes.
But it destroyed the department. It was quite abominable.
Who do you think were Marxists at that time?
Well, everybody in the terms of economic anthropology was pursuing a Marxist approach. There was no other permitted form of approach.
Mm.
And I'm sorry, but this was not my form of approach.
When you said Cornford, I mean, the other famous Marxists were Needham, Bernau,
yes,
and so on. Mm. Did you know any of them?
No. I knew Needham by sight, and I have heard about Bernal from Dorothy Hodgkin, the famous Nobel Prize winner, who was the wife of my friend Thomas that I have earlier mentioned.
Yes. Mm. So it was mainly which were the Marxists who were...
Well, it was just a general atmosphere. Margot Heinemann at Newnham College was a famous Marxist, and one respected her enormously for this capacity to be a famous Marxist. She was the girlfriend of John Cornford, who, as you know, was killed age 21 in the Spanish Civil War.
Was he? Mm. He wasn't the Cornford who wrote...
He was a member of the Cornford family.
Mm.
His father was the famous professor of classics.
Oh, yes.
Mm. Mm. But a very clever historian who's quite brilliant. He had an illegitimate child who's around called Cornford, who's somewhere in academia.
Mm.
But he died more or less on his 21st birthday in the Spanish War.
Mm. So you fled Cambridge and went back to... You went to India.
I went to India.
Why did you go to India?
The reason I went to India was that I'd been fortunate enough to have been invited to Sri Lanka,
yes,
the year before by a good friend of mine, Barbara Sansoni,
yes,
a famous manufacturer of cloth, which she exports in vast quantities, a very artistic and interesting woman, a Sri Lankan herself, of course. And when I got to Colombo, where she lived, I felt enormously at home.
Mm.
And I was really surprised by this. And it gave me a feeling that my previous experience in West Africa was relevant to the Indian subcontinent. So that was why I went to India.
Hmm.
The authorities were very good in granting me a year's study leave.
Yes.
And it wouldn't have been any use at all, really, if I hadn't had a whole year.
You
I was extremely lucky.
The smarts.
Yes, I suppose so. Yes, because they financed me, and I mean, I paid for my assistance out of finance from the Smuts Fund and so on. And I was also lucky because at that time, when you arrived in India, you didn't have to show any visas. I was nervous about this on the plane. And when I arrived, they said, "How long are you proposing to stay?" So I said, "1 year," and showed them my return ticket. "Good," they said.
That's nice. But why Bangalore? Why that area? Is there any particular...
This was extremely fortunate. A friend of mine had suggested a certain hopeless centre, which I, in fact, had nothing to do with when I got there. They were hopeless.
Which was that? Was that the Institute for Economic and Social...
I always forget the name of these institutes. They're all more or less the same. And
there's a famous one, the
yes.
Institute for Economic and Social...
Yes, that's right, and Srinivas was connected with
it.
That's right. Now, the great merit of Bangalore and of Karnataka is that it is situated at an altitude of 3,000 feet.
Yes.
And I flourished.
Not too hot.
No. And so this was extremely lucky.
Why did you have nothing to do with the Institute? You just didn't find it. You wanted to be away from academics, presumably, and get on.
I arrived there, and I received no reception whatever. And Srinivas was evidently jealous of anybody who was going to undertake actual fieldwork, and ignored me totally, although I'd had a letter of introduction from Meyer, as far as I remember. And, I mean, I went to visit him soon after I arrived. And soon after I arrived in the house, the table was laid, so I thought, good, I'm being asked to supper. But, oh no.
Yeah.
It was like that.
Mm.
So I just didn't bother with this institute.
Mm.
The only service they performed was in introducing me to a young man, an unemployed graduate, who would assist me. And that unemployed graduate seemed a little miserable. So I got him to invite a friend to join our team, who was a most delightful man, who I got on enormously well with and still in touch with.
Mm.
And so I had two excellent assistants, the first one being a statistician who did excellent in pseudo-demographic work in the villages. We worked in 6 villages.
Yes.
I found my study of the 6 villages in the southern state of Karnataka most interesting. We didn't live in the villages, for my 2 Indian assistants would not have been prepared to do this for caste reasons, nor would I, for that matter, for fear of isolating myself from the Harijans, the former untouchables, who were my chief interest and who lived in hovels. So I lived in a delightful colonial-style shack on the roof of a Bangalore hotel, since demolished. The book I wrote on my experiences, dated 1982, has a most unfortunate title. And as the press is unrepresented in India, it is in no Indian bibliographies. The paperback edition has been pulped by the press.
Can you remind us of the title?
Dry Grain Farming Families.
That's right.
The point being that I was most surprised to find that insofar as Indians cultivated unirrigated grain, their position was extraordinarily similar to that in Hauserland. So the book was a comparison. For instance, I showed that the farm labouring system in Hauserland was identical in all particulars, I mean in, say, 12 details, with the farm labouring system.
What sort of details, for example? Just one or two examples.
Well, the farm labourers were, on the whole, small farmers who hadn't got enough work. How can I put my mind back? I mean, I list in the book about 12 different points, which were all totally identical in the 2 areas. But, of course, economists aren't interested in this kind of thing.
No, it fell between stools, presumably, because economists thought it was anthropology and anthropologists thought it was economics. So.
Well, it was rather unreadable, and I suppose it was a foolish thing to write a book dealing with both Hauserland and South India.
It makes it more interesting.
But anyway, I mean, insofar as economists want generalizations about farm labouring systems, they can find plenty there, I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. But they don't.
Did you, just one last question on that, did you get any impression as to whether, it's a very crude question, but the standard of living and the wealth in Africa or in India, which was, were they roughly comparable, or one was noticeably wealthier than the other?
Yes. There were, in Karnataka, there were a small number of really quite prosperous men in villages who, on the whole, were lacking. And they had big houses and so on, you know, well-built houses, which were, on the whole, lacking in Hauserland. But I found that the pattern of economic inequality in general was not dissimilar in the 2 areas, and I took a very keen interest in the position of the Harijans.
What year was this? 1976, what did you say?
The year I went to India was, I was appointed Smuts leader in 1973, which was the year in which Jack Goody became professor. And it may have been
about 76.
Six, probably 76.
Because we went there 20 years later to the same area, and I wondered whether, for instance, if you went into a village near Bangalore at that time, would you have seen
Well, this is an interesting point. What they said to me at this institute was, oh, you cannot work within the shadow of Bangalore city, because everybody in the villages works in the city, migrating. I said, I do not believe you. From my experience in West Africa, I know that if I go to a village off a main road, I shall not find this to be the case. And I was completely right. So I went to a lovely village called Hulaheli.
How far from Mangalore was it?
About 18 miles, I should think. And I walked over a lovely paddy field to get to it. And so I cannot answer your question, because there were no cars in that village.
Yes. Were there any tube wells? Because one of the features that's very prevalent now is this use of electricity. Most of the villages have electricity.
No, we had no electricity in Hulaheli.
And so they weren't able to drive down and get the water bill.
No, they had the most preposterous wells, these six villages. They were larger in radius than this room and extremely shallow. I couldn't understand them. But of course, tanks were the main form of irrigation.
Yes.
The water flowing down. And being regulated, which is a very interesting question, the water supply being regulated by Harijans who held hereditary posts. This wasn't in the literature. This was quite different from the situation in Sri Lanka, as dealt with by Edmund Leach, for instance.
So this was this, when you say it's dry grain, it really was dry grain, the irrigation were all the water was for drinking water and animal water rather than irrigation water?
No, what I mean is that both forms of crop were grown in any village. Irrigated crops, irrigated by tanks.
Rice?
Yes, and that was what we call paddy there.
Yes.
Yes, and then there was also a very inferior form of millet. I never understood why it was cultivated, because the yield per acre was so low, called ragi.
Right.
And that was non-irrigated, you see.
And was it the case that it was the choice was between very inferior ragi or nothing? In other words, it wasn't land which you could use for rice, and therefore you had to grow, if you wanted to grow something, this was about the best you could do.
Well, I was not able to meet a botanist to understand why such a hopeless form of millet was cultivated, so inferior to the sort of millet I knew in Hauserland, in terms of the yield per acre. But I was never able to ascertain why that was so. I was again able to base my work, which is highly respectable, on economic inequality, on actual figures of acreages. Because, as you know, you cannot ask farmers to tell you their acreages. They do not think in those terms. Insofar as they give you a reply, it's useless. And so I spent a lot of time with my excellent assistant, Gopal, in analysing, analysing the village.
What was his surname?
Gopal, B.A. Gopal.
Oh, B.A.
They always called each other, my two assistants, Mr. Gopal and Mr. Diwaka. And they always called me Madam, which I protested about. And when Susanna arrived, they called her Madam, which I protested about.
So they pretended.
To begin with, they were very shy, and they used to go behind a hedge to eat their lunch. Gradually, they became less shy and ate their lunch in my presence.
Were they Brahmins or?
No, no.
Just
no. Ordinary mid-caste. Yes, just an ordinary. Gopal was particularly good at getting on with Harijans. He was totally unprejudiced.
Did you notice any difference in the, I mentioned the wealth, but what about the sort of personality and the character of the people as compared to the people you've met in West Africa? Were they more, they'd had a much longer oppression of a caste and hierarchical system. Were they more, so to speak, repressed and quiet and subservient than the people you've met in Africa?
An interesting difference between them and Hausa people was that they were very curious about my own homeland. and would say to me, for instance, often, how many farmers are there in your village? And when they learnt there was only one, they really were annoyed.
Annoyed?
Well, yes, because it was incomprehensible.
Yes, so they showed a wider interest.
Yes, I would say so, definitely. Three languages, Tamil, Kannada and Telugu, were spoken in my village, Bhatkarawa. So whatever kind of linguist one had been, one would have had to have prepared oneself for some years before going there. Had it not been that Gopal knew all those languages, you see. So I was all right. It's a sort of peripheral area. Anyway, one has to beware of the hypothesis that cities necessarily expunge their hinterlands, which is what I was told at that institute, you see, the name of which I have appropriately forgotten. They do not do so.
Did you get the sense that the people from the institute often visited these areas? Or?
There was only one anthropologist, and he was deeply jealous of me because I bought this Fiat aged about 20 years, and he only had a motorbike on which he seldom went to the field. And as far as I could tell, I'd never written anything.
And you've forgotten his name, probably. As well.
Yes, I certainly have. My last field trip to the rural tropics was in 1982-3, when for 3 months only I visited Trivandrum in the state of Kerala, which stands in the extreme southwest of India. Kerala is famous, as you no doubt know, for having had at one time an elected communist government. Which was not the reason I wrote an article, Kerala is Different, Modern Nation Studies. Demographically, Kerala is different because, for example, the population lives dispersedly, not in overcrowded villages as in South India generally, and because abortion is freely available on demand for women with several children. Then, educationally, for females as well as for males, Kerala has most superior standards. But for me, Trivandrum at sea level was too hot, so that it destroyed the heat control mechanism of my body, finally putting paid to my tropical experiences. My father, A.V. Hill, who was a well-known physiologist who won the Nobel Prize as early as 1922, always told me that physiologists did not understand the heat control mechanism. If that is still true, it explains the ignorance of the doctors, which persist in ignoring my serious plight, brought on, as I suggest, by my prolonged field work in the rural tropical world. Well, you see, the rest of this paper originally related to
your fen work.
My work on the fens.
Would you prefer to talk about your current work on Cambridge women? Would that be? Could you briefly? Well, maybe you could summarise the Fenn work, just in a preliminary way.
Right. Stranded on stilts on the bank of the Great Ouse River, 14 miles from Cambridge, having completed my polemical textbook of 1986, a book which is quite popular in the USA.
Remind us of its title.
Development Economics on Trial.
Yes.
The Anthropological Case for a Prosecution. This book is quite successful in the USA, but not much read, although it remains in print now and has not yet been pulped by the Cambridge University Press.
What is the theme? What is the main indictment, so to speak?
That their premises are all wrong, and that if they would only read the anthropologists and get some of their premises right, how much more progress they would make. Now, this relates only to the rural tropical world.
Yes.
Let them get on with central banking and international indebtedness and all the rest of it.
Yes.
But when it comes to the rural tropical world, they are as ignorant as infants. They think they know things. For instance, I have heard it often said that, of course, there is no inequality in the rural tropical world. Why should there be? Couldn't be more wrong. And they do not condescend to read the work of anthropologists, ever. There were a couple called Bliss and Stern who ventured into India, Oxford people. They are most famous amongst economists because they actually did some field work and they actually studied farm labourers, but without any reference to anything anthropologists had ever done. I mean, I've spent years of my life studying farm labourers. But did Bliss and Stern pay the faintest attention to anything that had ever been done by anyone else? No, they were grand pioneers in a new field and derived an enormous reputation from this.
What other indictments? I mean, when you say the premises, firstly, they were wrong about inequality. Were there other central premises of economics which were totally inapplicable to the rural tropics? Yeah, what about the maximising theory based, I suppose, on classical economics of Adam Smith and so on, that men will seek profit above all other girls or goods? Was that the sort of thing you challenged, or the rationality, supposed rationality of, or the irrationality of peasants, or even the concept peasant?
Well, I was much taken up with the fact that I cannot abide the word peasant.
Yes.
Because it implies that all these people are merely subsistence farmers.
Yes.
Which indeed they were not.
Yes.
And you cannot say who is a subsistence farmer, because they themselves don't know if they are going to be growing enough grain to see them through to the next harvest or not.
Yes.
And the concept of a subsistence farmer is totally rickety.
So they were all, what you're saying is that almost everyone might well be involved in a money.
Yes,
economy.
That's right. And it would vary from year to year who was selling grain and who was not, according to their good fortune in the year in question. And I found groundnuts, the subject of groundnuts, very interesting. Oh, I'm deviating to Hauserland.
That's right.
Yes. I was thinking of the question of peasants.
Did you on the question of peasants, another strand in the peasant argument, as you know, is the theory that what one of the central features of peasantry is, according to certainly the Russian school and so on, is that the unit of production and the unit of consumption are more or less the same, that it's a family labour force determined by the social family who are working together and producing and consuming together, that is what really differentiates it from a capitalist or fully market economy. Did that seem to work or not?
Well, a particular point that interested me was the independence of women in Hauserland, but not in India. The position of women in India was parlous, whereas in Hauserland, these women who were in Muslim seclusion,
yes,
were producing many goods inside the houses for sale, such as groundnut oil, and buying groundnuts from their husbands at the market price.
Really?
Yes.
Separate economy.
Separate economy. In India, alas, the position of women was very, very poor.
Through all the castes, the same from top to bottom.
Yes. We had hardly any Brahmins in my villages, because the only Brahmins had been the accountants of the villages before the position of accountant was abolished. So there was perhaps one Brahmin in each village.
you said they had separate economies in Outerland, presumably in India they had a joint economy, so everything that the woman could produce or do was automatically the husband's property.
Yes, that's right.
So there was no possibility for independent activity by the
woman. That's right, no possibility.
Mm. In what way did this affect women? I mean, did you notice that they were very submissive, or that they were very depressed, or that they were very overworked, or that they were very secluded? I mean, how did their powerless position manifest itself?
Well, unlike the Hausa women, who don't work on their farmland because they're in Muslim seclusion, they worked on the farmland. But of course, they often live in joint families. I took a very great interest in the question of joint families. So much rubbish is talked about joint families. And saying that they're something of the past. Indeed they are not. What you have to do is to work out the proportion of potential joint families in terms of the existence of adults of the third generation. And the actual number. And then you see that, in fact, the joint family flourishes in the villages. I wrote an article on this in Modern Studies, called.
Was this the case in both, or this is India you're talking about?
I'm talking about India in relation to joint families, yes.
And do you think this again had an effect on the status of women? It made them property of a joint, so to speak, property of a joint family, part of a much larger whole, and therefore they were again pushed down in their status. Is that what you were suggesting?
Yes, well, of course, the position of women is hopeless if they live with their mother-in-law. If they're a widow, they can't remarry. In Hausa land, it was something rather different. It was called being in Gandu. That is to say, the son, the married son, worked with his father but didn't necessarily live with him. And so it wasn't so restrictive. I studied farm slavery in Hausa land. In fact, I'm very proud of the work I did on farm slavery. Because I'm not an important person, the literature has paid no attention to me. M.G. Smith's findings on farm slavery in Zaria, in Hausa land, are considered the text. He's quite wrong, because land tenure in Zaria was not proper Hausa land tenure. And his understanding of farm slavery was totally incorrect. I did a lot of work on farm slavery in Hausa land, which I found quite possible, provided you speak to people who are not themselves of slave descent, but who are only too ready to speak of those who are of slave descent. Many of those who are of slave descent are unaware of it.
Yes.
But clever people who are not themselves of slave descent are only too happy to expatiate on the past history of slavery. So I did some, I consider, excellent work, but it hasn't entered the literature. It's been ignored.
Did you know M.G. Smith at all?
I approached him when I was going to Hausa land, but he was too haughty to speak to me.
Really?
Yes, I went first of all to see Darrell Ford, whose great friend he was, of course.
Yes. And what was Ford like?
I knew Ford because I'd been to several conferences of which he was the chairman.
Yes.
And I really don't recollect. I just know that I got nowhere. And so I had to proceed on my own.
So you never met Smith, or you just...
I suppose I did. I know I made every endeavour to meet him, and I suppose I did, but I know nothing came out of it.
Yes. I mean, you referred to then, and obliquely elsewhere, to the fact that there's a kind of vicious circle, because if you aren't sufficiently whatever it is, placed in the right place in a profession.
That's right, because I had no academic job, you see. I was always on grants.
Yes. You think this is the basically, if you have a kind of niche in the centre of a professional group, then people listen to you. Because it has been noticed that sometimes this is even occurs within a person's life, that is to say, when they retire or when they decide to leave a job and go off. Nowadays, that quite often means that your work is partly ignored after your retirement, or if you decide to become something else. This is a recent phenomenon, because most of the great people, as you know, like Darwin or Adam Smith or whatever, wrote their great works away from academic positions, and that was no hindrance. But with the professionalisation of the disciplines.
Yes. That's right, you see, because I have no real student followers, because I was always a loner who's doing work in the field on her own. And so I didn't have, in West Africa or anywhere, any people who regarded me as a master.
So you didn't have a school?
No.
But you said previously, and you haven't mentioned it here, that you did take a PhD in anthropology. Was that...
Yes, it was based on my book, The Migrant Cocoa Farmers of Southern Ghana, and this is the book which Goody was the examiner for. Mm. That's why I was protesting about him calling me an economist.
I see. This was under special regulations.
Yes, I was the first person under those special regulations to take a PhD under those regulations.
I see.
Mm. This was around 1966.
You did, in fact, refer to yourself earlier. You said, at that time, I was an economist. At what part-time do you think you sort of began to feel, well, I'm not an economist, I'm more an anthropologist?
In the course of my work on the migrant cocoa farmers, I really began to think I was an anthropologist.
Mm.
But there was nothing I could do about it, except that Maya encouraged me. Stranded on stilts on the bank of the Great Ouse River, 14 miles from Cambridge, having completed my polemical textbook of 1986, I was in worse plight than ever before. How could I endure life as an indigene? Rather uncertainly, I decided to do some desultory fieldwork in my childhood hinterland, the Cambridgeshire Fens. I cannot claim to have been told about webbed feet in the fens, such as I actually described in a book by a certain fen physician. But as I was looked after in my infancy by a horrible Cambridgeshire nursemaid, she may have frightened me with some fen stories. It is interesting that my younger sister, who had the advantage of a very superior Cambridgeshire nurse, writes, "I think I grew up with the ideas that fen people were different, dark, strong, and somehow dangerous, but special nevertheless." Although my sister happens to be a psychoanalyst, she doesn't know where these ideas came from. My paper, Who Were the Fen People?, published in the august proceedings of the Cambridge Antiquarian Society in 1992, relates to Fenlanders from c. 1800 to c. 1950, for everything changed soon after the Second World War, when as a result of the amazing agricultural revolution, Fen workers assumed new roles. In that period of 1.5 centuries, most Fenlanders were employed farm workers, resembling farm workers in non-fen country, and or peat cutters. They were not freelancers who sloshed about as hunter-gatherers. Those who believe in the hunter-gatherers are still living in the 18th century, ignoring the agricultural revolution which occurred in the fens as long ago as the first half of the 19th century. Apart from the large number of farm labourers, there were local people, always known as smallholders, who cultivated small areas without the help of employed labour, except possibly at harvest. And there were farmers proper, not necessarily local people, who were those responsible for farming most of the land with the help of employed farm labourers. The work of draining the fens, and I refer here to the East Anglian fens, whether they be situated in Cambridgeshire, Suffolk or Norfolk, not to the silt fens further north. The work of draining the fens started in 1631. And for 6 years, the fenlands were filled with thousands of men cutting huge channels, such as the old Bedford Level, across the landscape. The Civil War interrupted the work, but by 1652 it was completed, the new Bedford River having been added by then. The wise men of Cambridge University were opposed to the general drainage of the fens, which started, They urged that the Cam would have its stream dried up by the drainage. And as Cambridge is concerned in its river, I quote, so the well-being of the whole country, yea, of the whole kingdom, is concerned in Cambridge and its university, and the stream of knowledge would be dried up with the stream of Cam. However, the wise men did not really need to worry, for this original drainage scheme was a great calamity, owing to the resultant shrinkage of the peat. As the water was removed from the vast thickness of peat, the surface dried out, peat compacted, and the land sank. Huge floods covered the peat fens, which were then lower than the northern silt fens, and Denver sluice to the north, which controlled the waters of the new and old Bedford rivers, collapsed in 1713, resulting in watery chaos. The sluice was not rebuilt until 1750, and it was a long time before the drainage based on windmills, more properly wind pumps, which were initially privately owned, could be acclaimed as a success. The life of the Fenlanders has been little studied in this modern historical period. The notable Fen historians, with hardly an exception, have been medievalists, such as Margaret Spafford, or others who have stopped short of the re-drainage period. The renowned historical geographer Darby followed up his first book, The Medieval Fenland, with many publications on the re-drainage. His work was highly regarded for good reasons, but a sociological approach was generally lacking, and the glamorous history of the drains has ousted the mundane history of the people. Despite much persistence in the excellent records room of the Cambridgeshire County Council, I myself remain totally baffled by the subject of land tenure in the 19th century Fenland. I cannot begin to answer such a simple question as, who was in a position to take up newly drained land? I certainly found it much easier and much more agreeable to study land tenure in certain regions of West Africa than in the re-drained Cambridgeshire Fens. In fact, to my great misery, I was obliged to give up, which accounts for the meagreness of my Fen publications. When gossiping about my Fen work in a milieu, which I made a note of ordinary middle-class Cambridge, university people and others, the sort of people who are apt to drop in for lunch at my college Clare Hall, when gossiping about my work in such circles, I soon found myself up against stereotyped walls of prejudice, which were insusceptible to rational argument. While it might be thought that this was partly because everyone, with hardly an exception, had read the novel Waterland by Graham Swift, which was later to be made into a film. It was rather the other way round, that Swift, as a sensitive romantic writer, wrote about a mythical Fenland, which satisfied the emotional needs of non-Fen people, particularly those resident in the flat and boring landscape around Cambridge City. The author, like his readers, was possessed of a deep feeling of what Fenland life must have been like, although to his own admission he'd scarcely been there. His geography and place names were fictional, and the main theme was murder at a lock gate. The book is described on its jacket as being not just a superb evocation of place, but also a vision of England and the strange, stubborn English temperament. The Fens were fascinating, both because they were so peculiar and because they were so English. Note those words, the strange, stubborn English temperament. This Fenland, this palpable earth raised out of the flood by centuries of toil, no mention of the collapse of Denver sluice, is a magical and miraculous land. Fenland, I quote, is an ambiguous, amphibious domain through which we have all travelled, where past and present intermingle, where the drama of loss and reclamation is written in the landscape, where fable and illusion stalk the first vistas of fact. It is a book about beer, eels, the French Revolution, the end of the world, windmills, will-o'-the-wisps, murder, love, education, curiosity, and supremely the malign, merciful element of water.
That's from the dust jacket, is it?
Yes. In working on the Fens, I made use of the wonderful unpublished census statistics by household, which were first collected in 1841 and which earned the operation of a 100-year secrecy rule are available only until 1891. These statistics are available on microfiche in the county record office in Shah Hall. That office is packed out by individuals pursuing their family histories, but few academics are to be found there. After spending many a long month inspecting these figures, I think that in most respects they are surprisingly reliable, perhaps partly because the census enumerators gathered information from women, the men being out on the farms when they called. Thus the ages of children, judging from successive decennial censuses, were usually rather accurately recorded. I cannot understand why Cambridge historians ignore these figures. What a goldmine they ought to be. Imagine arriving at a locality in the rural tropical world and being handed statistics by a household in, say, 1851, which recorded the names of all members, including children, as well as the relationship to the household head, age and birthplace. Of course, enumerators sometimes found it difficult to determine the main occupation of the male householder. There were few female householders, and the statistics which were supposed to be provided on the areas of farm holdings and numbers of labourers employed appear to be quite unreliable. Modern historians are really remarkably casual in their acceptance of census material as gospel. For some decades after 1841, the published census figures, which were of course bulked, are the only source of information on numbers of farmers and their acreages. These figures are always complacently accepted as accurate by historians who do not bother to study the microfiche, which would have shown them how often the figures were rounded by those individual cultivators who didn't think in terms of total acreages. Fenlanders had a mobile outlook, the basis of which was that sons always left the parental cottage on marriage, often moving elsewhere to find a new labouring job and marrying a girl from another village. In Iselham Fen, an area near Iselham where I worked, the only sons who were an exception to this rule were the sons of publicans, whose habitations were superior. In Iselham Fen, all the four publicans in 1851 were important people, who were also farmers or smallholders. They provided the continuity which was lacking in other families, and their families tended to intermarry. Although a male publican was often succeeded by his widow, the public houses provided social centres for men only. Women had nowhere to go except to the Baptist chapel erected in 1841. The population of Iselham Fen, to the north of Iselham village, reached its peak in 1851, the same being true of each of the Fen parishes. Between 1851 and 1861, something extraordinary happened in Cambridgeshire. The population, after rising very steadily since 1801, suddenly fell by 5%. There was no other English county which suffered a larger decrease, and there were only three other counties where the population did not increase. While this remarkable change, remarkable within the whole English context, affected Cambridgeshire generally, for a majority of parishes showed some population decline, it was particularly consistent and marked in the parishes within the area of the peat fens, both east and west of the Bedford Rivers. So it seems that many Fenlanders, far from being embedded in ignorant isolation in the fens, were alert to the possibilities offered by removal, mainly to northern cities. There was also some emigration overseas.
Several times you've used the word hinterland.
Yes.
And I know that this is a sort of theme in a lot of your work. There's the city view of things, as you mentioned in Bangalore, the people in the institute have a view of these country people. But there's a hinterland to all these cities and these urban areas, and it's into these hinterlands you've gone and exposed many of the myths.
Yes.
About them.
Yes. So this paper, of which I've only given you excerpts, was a sort of disquisition on the concept of hinterland.
Yes. Mm. And you think that the sort of denigration of the people living in the hinterland is largely a fear of the unknown and...
Yes. Mm. Apart from the demographic misbeliefs, which were profound, including the presumed high rate of incest. Inquiries were made, but they weren't made anywhere else. And had they been, they would have shown that everywhere there was a much higher interest rate of incest than had been imagined. Apart from these demographic points, it was widely believed that the consumption of opium in the fens in the last century was very high, the belief being based on the presumptions that Fenlanders suffered from very bad health and are known to have grown poppies. A woman called Virginia Berridge, about whom I know nothing, has written three articles which are largely repetitive, purporting to prove on the basis of the flimsiest evidence that opium use was as normal for the people of the fens as it was for Coleridge and De Quincey. We should remember that in the 1850s opium could be bought in any shop. Charles Kingsley related that it was obtainable in Cambridge on market day, so that there were habitual users, including Charles Darwin's elder brother Erasmus, who never did a stroke of work in his life. I wanted to end my paper, which is a disquisition on hinterland, with some notes towards the definition of hinterland, but unfortunately I lack the necessary philosophical training. I can see some of the questions, but I can provide no answers. Is a hinterland necessarily partly imaginary? Do the indigenes of the hinterland itself regard those I have denoted as the indigenes as occupying a hinterland? In other words, what do hunter-gatherers think of arable farmers? Is a hinterland necessarily threatening? Is a hinterland necessarily exotic? Does a hinterland provide protection from something worse, etc.? You may wonder why I've provided no evidence that the Cambridgeshire Fenlanders were wild amphibious men before the re-drainage of the 18th century. This is because I can find no good description of them except that provided by Daniel Defoe, whose journey began in 1722, soon after the collapse of Denver Sluice. After saying that the fens near Ely Cathedral were covered with water and fogs, he observed that it was impossible not to pity the many thousands of families confined in those fogs and vapours. But notwithstanding this, the people, especially those that are used to it, live unconcerned and as healthy as other folks, except now and then an ague, which they make light of, and there are great numbers of very ancient people among them. This is hardly a description of wild amphibious men. I was very dissatisfied with my fen work, which I abandoned some years ago. I was much more satisfied by studying the position of middle-class women from about 1860 to 1900, with special reference to the earliest students at Newnham and Girton colleges. See my article in the May 1966 issue of the Cambridge Review.
Yeah. What was the main surprise you had when you came to study Cambridge women?
A main surprise was the extraordinary belief that became fashionable about 1880, when it was seen that women did very well at examinations. The opponents of women changed their tune and argued that it was unfortunate that for physiological reasons women were not capable of academic work, and it damaged they might be capable of passing examinations, but at the expense of their reproductive mechanisms.
So previously they'd been thought to be too stupid.
Yes.
And now that they were clearly intelligent enough.
That's right.
They had a view of the whole body, in which overdevelopment of one part led to the underdevelopment of another part.
That's right.
It's a kind of zero-sum game.
Yes. And this wasn't only believed in Cambridge, it was a common belief about women at that time, and that was the greatest surprise I received. This work was made possible because the biographical registers of Newnham and Girton, especially of Girton, are extraordinarily good, superior to any registers compiled by men's colleges. And so one has information relating to students from the earliest times, which has never been properly analysed and in a scientific kind of way.
What details did they include?
Most of what you would expect. But they are defective, of course, and because they are somewhat defective, people dismiss them altogether. But you have to use them with discretion. For instance, although they record the number of children born to those who married, the number is clearly too low. That's an example, but you just can observe this. But what you can also observe is the extraordinary significance of this demographic change that occurred around 1870. Mrs. Sidgwick did some work which showed that the students before 1880 or so belonged to families with an average of 6.8 children. But the students themselves had families of one, two, or three. There were no large families. It was a complete change.
Was this, I remember you had a very interesting appendix or footnote on contraception. Was this related to that? That was the mechanism?
I don't think so. And I think this is a very interesting question. I have been speaking to Peter Laslett recently, and I don't think he thinks so. Contraception had been available for a long time, but I don't think it was much used. I think, to put it as a joke, sexual intercourse went out of fashion towards the end of the 19th century.
The often it's said that they, as you say, that it wasn't artificial contraceptives, but that it was coitus interruptus.
Yes, I take account of that, but I was one does fear that abstention and coitus interruptus were very, very common. But most unfortunately, there is no information relating to individual cases. There are some good books by on sexuality in the 19th century by one Mason. And he says, I mean, most unfortunately, if you look in memoirs, letters, anything, you simply cannot find any information on this subject. You know nothing.
And you know that the pattern, I mean, one, this great change you mentioned, around the 1870s,
yes,
might have been accounted by the Malthusian, that is to say that the women who were educated tended to get married much later, and therefore they only had one to three children, whereas they were the daughters of families where the woman had married much earlier. That isn't the case.
I have been remarkably unsuccessful in ascertaining the age of marriage of persons of different classes. And I wish to see, if I continue with this work, I wish to see Peter Laslett again on this. The striking thing about this demographic transition, as it's always called, was that it affected all classes.
Yes.
And occurred at a time when child infant mortality, rather, was extremely high. It was extremely high until about 1900. And so it wasn't to do with the fact that you could rely on those who'd been born going on living.
And what do you think it was to do with? Do you have any idea?
I find it mysterious. It was not confined to Britain.
No.
Of course, the French had been using birth control since the early 19th century. But they too suffered from a demographic transition at around the same time as the British did in the 1870s. Mm. And there's a debate which, you know, the demographers don't provide an answer.
Mm. Well, a person who I know used to think a lot about it is Geoffrey Hawthorne. And he, as you say, there's been work on Portugal, Italy, France, Germany, England, and it shows the same phenomenon which goes
That's
across
right.
Protestant, Catholic, rural, urban, class divisions. Just sweeps right across.
Yes.
No correlation.
Yes.
Very mysterious.
Very mysterious. Very mysterious.
And he's unable to explain it.
Yes.
One or two questions about particular people, if you didn't mind. Something just about your father, A.V. Hill, the Nobel physicist and M.P.
physiologist.
Physiologist and MP for Cambridge.
University.
University.
Yes.
What sort of memories do you have of him?
He was very much inconvenienced in his life, that word is not appropriate, it's much more than that, by the fact that when he was 3 years old, his father had an affair with the nursemaid, or something of the kind, and he never saw him again. This made my father deeply prejudiced on all sexual matters, because he was afraid that he would go the same way. He never uttered the word father, and I was brought up to believe that he was dead, which annoyed me when I was told that he died when I was about 12 years old.
Your grandfather?
Mm. He was called Jonathan Hilden. He was a timber merchant in Bristol.
Jonathan Hilden?
Hill.
Hill.
Yes. I mean, my father, A.V. Hill, was the son of Jonathan Hill, timber merchant of Bristol.
So your father was brought up by his mother?
So he was brought up by his mother, who was very wise in moving to Tiverton so that he could go as a day boy to a Blundell School, which was an excellent public school, from which he got a scholarship to Trinity.
Yes.
So his career was made in that way.
I see.
Mm.
Do you happen to say anything about him apart from being very damaged in a way or influenced? I mean, was he a kind father or a distant father or both many things? You don't need to answer. There's a picture of him in the corridor at King's College.
There is indeed,
college.
In his lab.
Yes.
Mm.
Which I always pass and think of you and him.
Yes, a charming watercolour.
Mm.
Mm. I'm going through rather an awkward phase of thinking a bit ill of him, and I don't really want to record this particularly.
Okay.
Mm. Because I see him as having been so sexually conventional, for instance. And I see it as stemming from his most unfortunate experience.
Mm. So you understand it, but you're still hurt by it. What about, and I think you may feel the same about your mother, because she was obviously, you had an elder brother, did you?
No, younger brother.
Younger brother.
We were four, I had two younger brothers.
Yes, and mm-hmm. She, like many Victorian, Edwardian mothers, was keener on the sons than the daughters.
Well, certainly when I was born, she had no use for me, put me in black stockings and cast me out into the arms of a wicked nursemaid, which is recorded in family correspondence.
Mm.
So I'm going through an awkward phase of finding fault with her, and I don't particularly want to record this.
No.
Mm.
When you say wicked housemaid, I mean, you probably got no worry about, I mean, she was just...
Well, she couldn't stand me. But my mind has been widened recently by the fact that I have unexpectedly got two infant granddaughters.
Yes.
And one of them seems to be my reincarnation. I had auburn hair, and she has two. And she's terribly naughty.
Mm.
And so I was the black sheep of the family, but had the misfortune to be the eldest.
Yes.
And I can just see myself resembling Matilda.
So you see some of the problems from the other side.
Yes.
And then, not only, your mother was presumably a Keynes, wasn't she?
Oh, yes. She was her elder brother was John Maynard.
Yes.
Her younger brother was the famous Geoffrey, who had this double career. He was a remarkable literary man as well as being a surgeon.
Yes.
Mm.
I wondered if you could just say something about those two mother's brothers.
Well, I have written about Maynard because I edited a volume of the letters of Lydia and Maynard.
Yes, I've got that.
You have.
Mm.
And in the introduction to those letters, I have written about him.
Mm.
I feel much affinity with Maynard, and often think about him, and can't believe that he's been dead 50 years. I recently was asked by the World Service to make some remarks about him, commemorating the 50th anniversary of his death. He's a very constant presence in my life.
Mm. What affinities did you feel towards him?
Can't say.
Just a...
Yes. Just a...
He was a polymath, wasn't he? Interested in so many different things.
Yes, of course he wrote this treatise on probability.
Yes.
His father, as I have already said, was a moral scientist.
Mm.
And I criticise Maynard for not having realised what he derived from his excellent father.
Yes.
Who was a demure man, who, as I mentioned before, became registrar of the university, who was totally devoid of ambition, but who must have had more of an influence on Maynard than he was prepared to admit. Phyllis Dean has nearly finished a wonderful biography of John Nevile Keynes, which I hope will be published.
Oh, good. Mm. What about the younger brother, Geoffrey?
Well, he was an astonishing man because he led a double life. He was a full-time surgeon at Barts. A great authority on Blake, as you will know.
Yes.
And worked every evening on his literary work. I mean, at an early age, soon after the war, he produced a complete non-such edition of Blake's publications.
Yes.
His sons were very annoyed about it because they said they never saw him. He had four sons.
He would tend to come back from the day at the hospital and disappear into his study, and that was it.
Yes, and at the weekend he used to have medical students around to visit him.
Mm.
And
do you remember him as a person?
Yes, he had no use for females.
Mm. Was that the case with John Maynard as well, or not?
Oh, no. Geoffrey always tried to show his Blake pictures to my brother, who wasn't in the least interested.
Mm.
I'm a freak in our family because I'm interested in such matters as art and poetry.
Mm.
My father had no interest in any such thing. I mean, he was extremely limited in his outlook.
Mm.
And the others weren't interested either.
Mm. Keynes was. I mean, John Maynard was. He collected paintings.
Oh, yes. Of course.
Poetry.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's why he married Lydia, because he felt himself to be needing to be expanded.
Yes.
People are so absurd. They say, why did two such different people marry? Well, the answer was that Maynard found Lydia so literary and artistic and wasn't sure that he was himself, having been brought up in such a bourgeois, boring home with such dreadful furniture.
Yes. What about the other Keynes, Milo Keynes? What relative is he?
He's a first cousin. He's the third son of Geoffrey.
Hmm. What does he do? I know the name.
He was a surgeon at one time, but recently he's been doing excellent work on the health of famous men, which he publishes in eminent places like the Royal Society.
I mentioned
that he'd written a piece on Long. An article on Newton.
Yes.
Mm. There are four of them, and Richard Keynes was the professor of physiology in Cambridge, now retired, of course.
Yes.
Mm.
There's a Simon Keynes, who
is the son of Geoffrey.
Anglo Saxon scholar.
In fact, three of these 11 fellows that I mentioned are the sons of Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Is it three? Or is it two? Anyhow, there's Simon Keynes, who's an Anglo-Saxon scholar at Trinity, and there's another fellow at Trinity, curiously, which is a rather unusual thing, who's a scientist.
Cambridge has these various academic families who are interrelated. Are you interrelated with any other of the Cambridge...
Our branch of the family isn't, but of course Richard Keynes is, because he married Adrian's daughter.
Ah, yes.
Mm.
Lord Adrian.
Mm. The first Lord Adrian.
Yes.
The second Lord Adrian, unfortunately, died recently.
that you are related, for instance, to Nicholas Humphrey.
He is my nephew.
Yes. And hence into our department to Caroline Humphrey.
Yes.
I was wondering, the other question I wanted to, well, there are two other questions. One was just to ask you whether you mentioned Meyer several times, Meyer Fortes, whether there was any other, either anthropologist or economist or any academic, who had, you think, influenced you in your work.
Well, in my young days, I was very admiring of Joan Robinson, who was my supervisor.
Yes.
I did meet her in Trivandrum, of all places, towards the end of her life.
Yes.
Because she used to visit Trivandrum regularly.
Yes.
Her health was very bad, and she didn't live long after that.
Yes.
The African Studies Centre was a wonderful centre for me, and as I've said, there was Thomas Hodgkin there.
Mm.
And
Wilkes.
Mm.
So it was more African historians.
Yes, those were the people I knew, and unfortunately Hodgkin died in 1972, which is a tragedy.
Mm.
Wilkes is flourishing in Wales.
Mm. Mm. And you know the current director of the African Studies Centre quite well, Keith Hart.
Oh, yes, I know Keith Hart well.
Yes. You know him. You've known him
for some, yes. Oh, I can't say what the origins of my knowing Keith Hart are.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The other question is really about how you work. How do you, I'm interested in how people actually write and so on. You talked earlier, but you don't use any kind of electronic gadgets, but do you write easily, in longhand, heavily prepared, or how do you work?
Until recently, I typed everything on one of these huge manual typewriters.
Yes.
And I always went through many drafts, and I left the first draft sit down for at least a month.
Yes.
Before having a look at it and always deciding it was abominable. The only thing is to take a deep breath and write what you think at the time is wonderful.
Yes.
And then you read it and you find it's abominable.
Yes.
And this is, of course, as we were discussing earlier, one of the bases of my objection to word processes.
Yes.
Because let it lie latent and come back and start afresh.
Mm.
And so I used to type, as I was such a good touch typist, I used to
retype. So what would you do with the first draft? You would just put it on one side?
Oh, throw it away. But I mean, I would use it as the basis for another draft. But I would throw it away. But
yes.
I would completely redo it.
Yes.
And I might do that four times.
Yes.
I rewrote enormously.
Mm.
Four
times you do it.
I think so. I think four might be the...
Mm.
Because if I laid it aside and then came back, I always find that I didn't like it. And the quickest way to proceed was then to just retype.
Mm.
Completely.
Yes. Looking at it from time to time.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Did you enjoy that actual process of writing or not?
I was always a very nervous writer. I always felt that my inspiration was about to give up.
Hmm.
I had 6 books published by the Cambridge University Press. I started writing when I was really young, but as I mentioned that I wrote a book when I was with the Fabians before the war.
Yes.
So I suppose I was a person who found it necessary to write.
Mm.
Mm.
So it was not exactly a pleasure, but something you felt you could do and should do.
Yes, and I'm not able to work in the evening.
When do you work best?
I work best in the morning,
mm.
but I would always stop working between 5 and 6.
Mm.
Absolutely working. Impossible. My brain's no good at all in the evening.
You'd work in the afternoon as well?
Yes.
Mm.
Mm. Well, when I was in the village of Bartagarawa in Hauserland, I used to talk to people in the morning and type my notes in the afternoon. Fortunately, my archives, that is to say my field notes, which are all typed, so I'm a very, very good anthropologist from that point of view, are in a splendid library, there at the Africana Library at Northwestern University, which is reputed to be the best Africana library in the world.
Mm, that's excellent.
They asked me to send them.
Mm.
This was because Ivor Wilkes was there, and of course it's through his influence that they asked me to send them.
Yes,
mm.
That's good.
And if I want anything, but at the moment I don't think I ever again will want anything, I only have to send for it and they'll send me a photocopy, you see, so it doesn't matter that it's as far away as Northwestern.
That's excellent.
They're extremely efficient.
Did you index your field notes in any way?
I always index everything,
mm.
most elaborately. Because I have an abominable memory. I'm surprised I haven't told you before.
Hmm.
I'm most inconvenienced by my abominable memory.
Hmm.
So that I have to index everything. And I always have.
How did you index it? Not
and cards.
Hmm.
Conventional
cards.
Way.
By subjects?
Yes.
Hmm. So everything on property or everything on...
Yes, I mean, you'd find a card for donkeys, as it were.
Yes. Hmm. You'd keep this card and then go right through and add further references.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, tin box with cards in.
Have you? Did
yes.
you send that to?
No, I didn't send that to Northwestern.
That was rather probably a rather important part of it if you finally get them to ask you for it.
Oh, I don't think so. No.
Well, yeah. Finally, well, we were just going to end the funding there, yeah, but was there... anything else you wanted to reflect on, comment on in your life and experiences?
Well, I would say my extraordinary good fortune, after suffering greatly by my inability to get into academia in arriving in Ghana, which I have emphasized strongly already, my extraordinary good fortune in giving birth to my daughter when I was 42 years old. After having had medical problems.
Hmm.
Those two things are of extraordinary importance to me, and I feel extremely fortunate.
Hmm.
And so, after a slow start, I feel that I've been very lucky.
Hmm. Well, you've made a very distinguished contribution, if I may say so, Polly, so I'm going to just let you... You had something that you wanted to just end up with?
Yes. Just at the moment, July 1996, I'm in the doldrums again. A certain influential women seem to be opposed to my unconventional, indeed eccentric, anthropological approach to the early women students. As I am so dreadfully sensitive to opposition, I fancy I shall now abandon that work. It occurs to me that I am well qualified to write about Cambridge as a military centre in the 1914-18 war. Hospitals in the backs, wounded victims of the Somme in the Arches of Neville's Court in Trinity. There should be a lot of useful material in the Cambridgeshire room, in the collection of newspapers in the Cambridgeshire room of the City Council.
Oh, well, that would be extremely nice and interesting, and as we discussed earlier, would have some link in some way with Pat Barker's work on rivers and the war.
Yes, it's not disconnected with the fact that I became so infatuated by Pat Barker.
Yes.
Mm.
But I think perhaps we'll end there, and I'll comment on the other bit of it. But thank you very much indeed, Polly.
Thank you, Alan. It's been very good of you to take such a lot of trouble.